Welcome to Food for Thought. My name is Colleen Patrick-Goudreau from Compassionate Cooks. I founded Compassionate Cooks to empower people to make informed food choices and to debunk myths about vegetarianism and animal rights. You can learn more about us at CompassionateCooks.com or JoyOfVeganBaking.com, and you can connect with other listeners of this podcast by visiting CompassionateCooks.com and clicking on our message board under podcast. So, hi everybody. I was smiling as I was doing that intro because I imagine some of you probably know that by heart. So, hi everybody. It's good to be here. Today, before we get started, I'd like to thank today's sponsor, Barb Deggans, who recently told me why she sponsored the podcast. And she wrote this. She wrote, "I sponsored because when I decided to begin my transition to a vegetarian lifestyle, I was not given much support. Surprise, surprise, Barb, you're not alone out there. I really needed your voice on my iPod telling me that I was doing the right thing, that I wasn't being too politically correct or ridiculous, that it's not wrong to tell my kids the truth about the world, that I can and should be comfortable living my truth, and I do not have to justify it to anyone else. Of course, being new to tofu, I also needed information, which you provide in abundance. Now I'm informed and comfortable in my decision and my eating. My family has become more supportive, and I've become more confident saying no to situations that are not in my comfort zone. I still love the podcast and listen to each new one, but you got me to a point where I don't need you anymore. I know there are other people out there who do need you, and many of us who enjoy listening to you, so I'm glad I helped you keep going by sponsoring a podcast. It feels really good to put a little money where I finally have the confidence to put my words and deeds." I think that's great. I love that Barb doesn't need me anymore. My whole intention is to help you all feel confident and strong so that you can go out into the big bad world armed with information and resources, and so that you don't have to rely on me so much. And I'm really thrilled that you're all finding each other through the message board. So thank you, Barb. Thank you very much, both on behalf of Compassionate Cooks and on behalf of all of those who benefit from the work you help me create. Thank you. If you'd like to become a sponsor, you can do so by visiting the website, CompassionateCooks.com, and clicking on Support Our Podcast. You can support this work in a number of ways. It's up to you. You can become a monthly sponsor, or you can make a one-time contribution. Anything you can do is a huge help, and I really appreciate all of your support. Thank you all very much. So I want to sketch out a scenario for you. Just close your eyes and imagine yourself in this situation and see if you can identify either with the vegan or the non-vegan. I've been in this situation a number of times when someone's talking about their favorite dish and then they realize I'm there and they say with a very sad expression, "Oh, I'm sorry, you can't eat that." Or they go to offer you a piece of candy or something and then they say, "Oh, you can't eat that. I forgot. I'm sorry." Or they start thinking about a recipe and they start telling you about this recipe and then they start naming the ingredients and they say, "Oh, can you eat that? Or are you allowed to eat that? Or can you eat bread?" I love that one. That's my favorite for the record. Yes, I can eat bread. Here's the thing. I can eat whatever I want. There's nothing I can't have, but there are some things I don't want. Making a choice not to put in my mouth the pieces of an animal's body or the fluids that come from an animal's body is just that. It's a choice. I'm allowed to have whatever I want. Nobody's stopping me. It's not illegal. I don't follow a set of dietary laws, and I am technically quite capable of reaching for a piece of candy and putting it in my mouth. It's not a matter of not being able to. It's not a matter of can and cannot. It's a matter of not wanting to. I remember I was working for someone several years ago, a long time ago, and it was someone who wasn't very supportive of my being vegan. She was one of these people who didn't want to talk about it. She just didn't even want to broach the subject because it made her uncomfortable, and I know why it made her uncomfortable. She didn't want to talk about it because I know I was holding up a mirror for her. So I remember she did that once, and she offered me a piece of candy, and she just said, "Oh, I'm sorry." She pulled back, like she took it back. She pulled back the candy and said, "Oh, you can't have that." And I said, "I could have whatever I want." And she just took offense to that. She took offense to my saying, "Well, technically I can have it if I want." "Well, I know, but you can't." "But like but you can't have it." And I was like, "No, I can have it. I don't want it." And he was kind of uncomfortable, but that's what you got to do. You got to speak your truth and say it out loud. And it's helpful for people to hear that perspective. I think part of the problem is that it appears that being vegan is about saying no, about declining things that are offered to us. It appears that it's about deprivation or asceticism or sacrifice or martyrdom in some people's perception. That's the problem, the perception of what it means to be vegan. If you're on the outside looking in, what you tend to see is what we don't choose. You don't see what we are choosing. And maybe some of that has to do with the fact that in public settings, in a world dominated by the animal eating culture, people see vegans rejecting things far more than they see them embracing things. For me, being vegan is indeed about saying no. It's about saying no to cruelty and exploitation and violence, but it's also about saying yes. It's about saying yes to the abundance of plant choices that certainly even non-vegetarians have access to, but sometimes they don't even know they're there because they're not looking for them. For me, being vegan is about saying yes to my values, right? I mean, what's the use in having values if they don't manifest themselves in our behavior? I mean, we say that someone who lives their values has integrity. That's what it means to have integrity, right? That you actually live according to what you believe. Well, what does it mean to not live our values, and how many of us actually do translate our values into action? It's nice to say that we want to be kind or brave or caring or trustworthy, helpful people. These are some values that people say they have. It's nice to say that we're against violence and against cruelty. I think most people would say that that's a value they hold. But how many of us actually take these abstract values and put them into concrete action? For me, being vegan, which extends to every area of my life, is an opportunity to do just that, to put my abstract values into concrete action. By choosing not to eat the used and mutilated bodies of animals, I'm saying yes to my values of peace and nonviolence, of kindness to others, of compassion, of empathy, of freedom for others, for myself, of harmony, of simplicity. By choosing to look at what happens to other animals, human and non-human, on my behalf, which is often just for my convenience, just for convenience, I'm saying yes to my values of accountability, of responsibility, of commitment to truth and knowledge, of honesty and of openness. By standing up for what I believe in and fighting on behalf of those who have no voice, who have no rights, I'm saying yes to my values of fearlessness, of justice, of service to others, of generosity, of selflessness, of strength and courage and unity. My integrity as a human being isn't separate from my values as a vegan. It's all connected, right? It's all connected. Now, can you truly manifest your values and not be vegan? That's a question each individual has to ask himself or herself. Some people have different values. Maybe some people don't have values of nonviolence or peace or whatever. So everybody has to answer that question for themselves. But speaking for myself, when I became vegan, all the guilt and hypocrisy and conflict I ever felt about who I thought I was and who I was showing to the world just melted away. I didn't have that feeling when I wasn't eating land animals but was still consuming their products, you know, cow's milk and chicken's eggs. I didn't have that feeling, but that feeling of that guilt and that hypocrisy, that conflict really did go away when I became vegan. And that has been the most incredible feeling. For me, being vegan is about expansiveness and openness. And I know I've said that before, but it's not about restriction. It's not about limitation. It's not about rules. It's not about doctrine. I'm not forbidden to eat animals. I don't want to eat animals, right? That makes sense. And this is why I thoroughly despise the use of the phrase dietary restrictions or dietary limitations or special diet requests. It's also why I don't like the phrase strict vegetarian. It just sounds so rigid and clinical. The truth is, sometimes even the word vegan feels small to me because I wonder if it really describes everything I just said about it encompassing so much. But then I remember Donald Watson's definition of the word vegan and his intention in coining it. Now, in case you didn't know, the word vegan was coined in 1944 by Donald Watson, an amazing man, an amazing British activist and founder of the first vegan organization. Now, this was in England, mind you. He lived from 1910 to 2005, which made him 95 when he died. He died just 2 months after his 95th birthday. And we haven't really talked much about, I don't think we've talked at all about Donald Watson. And I think it's about time we do, since he was a pioneer and a truth teller, and he paved the way for all of us today. Donald Watson was born in Yorkshire, which is in the northern part of England, which is also where the Bronte sisters are from, if you remember from your English classes. And as you might imagine, vegetarianism, let alone veganism, wasn't exactly popular. So you think you have it bad in, I won't name any places, but you think you have it bad wherever you are. Just imagine it being 1930-something in this farming and meat-eating community in which he grew up. And actually, as I said that, I imagine some of you can identify with that. But his parents were very supportive, which helped, and they were very accepting of the choices he made. Over the years in interviews and such, he talks about his early memories of his childhood when he saw animals pushed through doors alongside butcher shops to be killed. He talks about the time he saw a cow and a calf enter together, and he wondered later which one the butcher killed first. On another occasion, he watched a cow being killed at an abattoir, which is a slaughterhouse in a field where local children could see everything, you know, where the children could witness it, you know, this kind of really difficult thing to witness. And he talks about being at his Uncle George's farm, where various animals were kept. And he remembers, he says, that, and this is in his words, they all gave something. The farm horse pulled the plow. The lighter horse pulled the trap. The cows gave milk. The hens gave eggs. And the cockerel was a useful alarm clock. The sheep gave wool. And he said, I could never understand what the pigs gave, but they seemed such friendly creatures, and they were always really glad to see me. Then the day came when one of the pigs was killed. I still have a vivid recollection of the whole process, including the screams. One thing that shocked me was that my Uncle George, of whom I thought very highly, was part of the crew. I decided that farms and uncles had to be reassessed. The idyllic scene was nothing more than death row, where every creature's days were numbered by the point at which it was no longer of service to human beings. Now, for me, stories like these that people like Donald Watson tells, people who grow up on small farms, who are either desensitized to the violence they witness or who become traumatized by it or both, just add more weight to the argument that the problem is not merely about the ways in which we keep and kill animals, but rather that we keep and kill animals. I can't tell you how many emails I get from people who tell me their experiences of what it was like growing up on a small farm and witnessing the animals being killed, or witnessing the animals being there one day and the next day them not being there. This takes a huge toll on the children especially, but on everybody who's in this situation. And this whole movement that calls for the return to the small farm, and, you know, nothing wrong with return to the small farm when it comes to vegetables and plant foods, in my opinion. But this idea that if we just return to the small farm in terms of animal agriculture, everything would be fine. But this is an impossibility, first of all, unless people substantially reduce their consumption of animals. This is just a farce. It's a farce because it assumes that you're preventing cruelty by killing animals humanely. And of course, you know that I would argue there is no such thing. And it's a farce because if you look at the people and the organizations who have usurped the ethics, particularly organizations like Slow Food USA or Alice Waters or Heritage Foods USA or all of these little groups that have grown up around this philosophy, they are huge proponents of meat consumption. So they don't just come out and say, let's all, you know, actually substantially reduce or eliminate our consumption of animals and really focus on plant foods. They're huge proponents of meat. They might talk about locally grown and seasonally eaten foods, but what they emphasize more than anything else is meat. Any animal and every animal that could be killed and consumed by humans. And I see this on the menus of all these kinds of places. I have to say, what's really funny these days, and I do go to mostly vegetarian restaurants, but when I go out to a non-vegetarian restaurant, I find it really amusing in a sick sort of way that every time there's a mention of an egg or a chicken or some kind of animal, there's always something that says naturally raised or humanely raised or small farm or cage free or free range or all of this language that has grown up around this. And it's not possible. They can't possibly continue to serve the amount of animal products they're serving and have these all come from small farms. So anyway, this is just really interesting to me because the story that Donald Watson tells about his being traumatized, witnessing these animals killed or just hearing them killed, was what changed his life. And Donald Watson was no different than you or me. I mean, he's human. He's not superhuman. He's special. He was a very, very special man in the truest sense of the word. But he's not extraordinary in the sense that he, like many of us, recognized the torment that those animals experienced. And he reacted the way many before him reacted and the way many of us react today. His logical response to it was to stop eating the victims of animal agriculture. This wasn't factory farming. This was small, localized animal agriculture. He was 14 years young and it was 1924. He didn't do it because it was trendy or popular or hip. He did it because he didn't want to be part of the inherently cruel and unnecessary process of bringing life into this world for the sole purpose of cutting it short and cutting it up. And Watson made a New Year's resolution and it stuck for 81 years until he died. 18 years after he became vegetarian, he became vegan. He was 32 years old and it was 1942 and his brother and sister eventually joined him. And early concerns, obviously people, parents and family members had concerns about their potentially doing something dangerous for their health, eventually subsided like most of us experienced. And he went on to help form the Vegan Society, the first vegan organization in the UK in 1944. Now, just to give you some perspective, the first vegetarian society was founded in 1847. Okay. And that was in Ramsgate in Kent in England again. And so that's the Vegetarian Society, 1847, and the International Vegetarian Union was founded in 1908 with their first World Vegetarian Congress in 1908 in Dresden, Germany. And so this year, 2008, marks their 100-year anniversary, and there's a chance I may be speaking there at their big congress this year, which is their 100th-year anniversary in Dresden, Germany. So that would be just incredible. And if you're listening to this after 2008, let's just say I may have spoken there at the World Vegetarian Congress in Dresden, Germany. So going back to the Vegetarian Society, 1847, they were really the first to popularize the word vegetarian. Now, they claim to have created the word vegetarian, which I think is interesting, just so you can bring this up in conversation. It's just something to ponder. They claim to have created the word vegetarian from the Latin vegetus, meaning lively, which is how they felt being vegetarian. But the Oxford English Dictionary states that the word was formed from the term vegetable. Now, regardless of whether the word was derived from vegetus or vegetable, the point is that Donald Watson became frustrated by a philosophy of living that was initially intended to embrace the freedom from all exploitative products, but which came to include eggs and cow's milk and honey. Now, as editor of Vegan News, which was the very popular publication of the Vegan Society, in which Donald single-handedly wrote and edited, he asked his readers to come up with a more concise word to replace non-dairy vegetarian. And he said he got some bizarre suggestions. I'll name some of them. They were dairy ban. So instead of a vegan, you'd be called a dairy ban. I guess this is Vitan, V-I-T-A-N. You'd be a Vitan, which is kind of cool because it sounds like Viking or Titan. Benivore, B-E-N-E-V-O-R-E, which would technically mean, I suppose, eating good, eating goodness, which, okay, that might work. So you'd be a benivore or sanivore, which I'm not really sure what the etymology would break down to. Maybe clean, S-A-N-I would be clean. So sanivore, which sounds like some, I don't know, dinosaur of some kind. So just be happy that Donald and Dorothy, his wife, decided on the word vegan instead of sanivore by taking the first three and the last two letters of the word vegetarian. Because, as Watson said, veganism starts with vegetarianism and carries it through to its logical conclusion. So that's how he got the word vegan, and the word was accepted by the Oxford English Dictionary, and no one has tried to improve it since. You want to go around calling yourself a sanivore? You go right ahead. I don't want to be a sanivore. Although it could be kind of cool. So anyway, but he was adamant, as some of us are, about the pronunciation, which is vegan. So be sure to gently correct people when they say vegan, or when they say vegan, or when they say vegan, just vegan, and just correct them with a smile. So Donald and Dorothy Watson coined the word vegan, and its definition is very precise and very simple. This is how they defined it. Veganism is defined as a philosophy and way of living which seeks to exclude, as far as is possible and practical, all forms of exploitation of and cruelty to animals for food, clothing, or any other purpose. And I love the simplicity of that definition. I love that it covers even that question of purity or perfection by saying, you know, as far as is possible and practical. And it also includes the idea of intention. It's a philosophy and way of living which seeks to exclude, you know, the idea that we're just doing the best we can. I love that. So it's all in there. As far as is possible and practical, all forms of exploitation of and cruelty to animals for food, clothing, and any other purpose. And as I said, being vegan informs every aspect of my life. How could it not? How can you hold a philosophy and live a life that seeks to exclude all forms of exploitation and cruelty to animals and not have it inform everything you say and do, especially when we live in a society that seems to be defined by its exploitation of and cruelty to animals? Being vegan is a powerful statement in a world that has lost its conscience. Now, I've said many times that I believe our language reflects our beliefs. So when someone says something about my dietary restrictions, I bristle. And I realize that the perspective of the person who's asking the question, especially if they've never been exposed to the fabulous abundance of veganism because of the way a vegan lifestyle is positioned in our culture and in the media, I realize that their perspective is that it's a restriction. For those who are on the other side, we know it's anything but a restriction. We know it's anything but a limitation, and that's what we have to get across. So when someone makes reference to our dietary restrictions, we can smile and again gently correct them and assure them that this is an expansion in every sense of the word, both in the practical aspects of food choices and in terms of the increased awareness and increased participation in the world and in our own lives. So you can tell them that you have no dietary restrictions, but rather, shall we say, you experience freedom and liberation. I don't know if there's a better phrase for dietary restrictions, dietary freedoms. I don't know, that sounds kind of corny, but the idea is that we get that message across that really turns that on its head. Now, if I haven't already made this clear, I obviously really feel strongly that this is what this transformation is all about. Liberation from guilt, liberation from the lies we've been told, liberation from participating in egregious, preventable cruelty, liberation from unhealthful food choices, and so many other things. Many of us have that feeling. I can't tell you how many people I hear from who tell me that they develop a deeper relationship with the animals with whom they live, their dogs or their cats or their bunnies, and even their fish when they become vegan. What's that quote by Franz Kafka? Now I can look at you in peace. I don't eat you anymore. That's the idea. Being vegan just liberates you in ways you can't even imagine, in ways you can never and will never expect. But first you have to experience it to see what I mean. In an interview with Donald Watson a few years before he died, he was asked if he had any message for the millions of people who are now vegan. And his answer was this: take the broad view of what veganism stands for, something beyond finding a new alternative to scrambled eggs on toast or a new recipe for Christmas cake. Realize that you're onto something really big, something that hadn't been tried until 60 years ago, and something which is meeting every reasonable criticism that anyone can level against it. And this doesn't involve weeks or months of studying diet charts or reading books by so-called experts. It means grasping a few simple facts and applying them. He goes on, we don't know the spiritual advancements that long-term veganism over generations would have for human life. It would certainly be a different civilization, and the first one in the whole of our history that would truly deserve the title of being a civilization. May you realize you are indeed onto something really big. If you feel the powerful effect of veganism in your own life, just imagine the potential it has to heal the whole planet. You can open your eyes now. This is Colleen with Compassionate Cooks. Thanks for listening.